Need to switch the soundboard back to the other controller. I like this controller better, but the volume is all on touch strips and I'm accidentally hitting it, which is why it was blasting just a second ago. Oh. Oh well. This is Pure Decking show number 409 for Thursday, September something, whatever the fucking year it is. This is a show about stuff that interests me, like information security. Somewhere in time. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and realizing that that's the same joke I told at the opening of the last show. I'm Morps, and tonight we have Are You. What is up, Are You?
Oh, man, just reminiscing of the before times.
When you could go outside and get a haircut and... Actually, in your case, not be tackled by the police for taking two steps. I mean, you got the whole Beetlejuice sandworm thing going on.
yeah, some crazy shit, man. Not my state, though. I'm pretty good so far. Touch wood. Yeah, man, it's just getting a little fuck crazy now, right? We got, what, 60 days to the election?
Yeah.
Grandpa? Yeah. Yeah. Well, we had 112 days of riots, you know, 5 months of Wu Flu, fucking no sports ball. And when there is sports ball, it's protest sports ball, so who gives a shit? Yeah, I'm having a great fucking year. How you doing?
Well, I've been locked inside since February, but you know, hey. Finally starting to get used to this working from home shit.
Yeah. PSV, we were talking about it a bit earlier. Getting way too comfy in our home offices now. Moving the fridge in, the recliner, the bed.
Not putting on pants to go to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you just put gaff tape over all the webcams and run that little application in the background that loops the video.
Oh, yeah. I now have a functioning webcam.
Oh, you actually at least have to put on a shirt before you go to work.
Oh, no. There's a little slider on the laptop that closes the webcam. I keep that closed.
Hey, rats, Australia, most of Australia anyways... is extremely is enforcing the lockdown to an extreme. They actually have police doing door checks and shit like that. He, in the IRC, he's asking what IRL, what are we talking about that RU can't leave his house? It's like sandworms. What?
I'll post some videos for you, man, during the show for you to watch.
Yeah, they were going around checking. I don't think in your state, but you said in other states they were doing that.
No, not my state. My state was the first one to be pretty clear, really, because we're not a bunch of bootlickers, but we do know what's good for us when we're told. And other states, not so much. And one of the states now who's just voted retarded for the last 20 years is feeling the full force of that retardation as their police force is. We got one in a coma. Going outside, hundreds of people arrested for fines, things like that, getting to the point where people are smuggling themselves out of the states in the back of trucks and stuff. Pretty crazy.
Well, I heard a sound clip of I think it was one of the state governors listing out the recent COVID deaths, and it was all people who were older than 70, and it's just like, you know, when somebody's 102, I don't know that you can explicitly blame it on COVID. It's actually pretty ridiculous, the restrictions they're putting in place versus the actual numbers. So it's just
I didn't realize the competition in life was to see who could live the longest. You know what I mean?
I thought it was who could bang the most hot chicks.
don't even know if it's that. It comes to a point where quality of life is better than quantity of life in my book.
Yeah, I suppose.
You know, and putting off dying right now or dying 10 minutes from now, yeah, let's get it over with, man. Let's do it. Done. Sick waiting.
And I suppose we should finish out the intro. Madman is here.
Hola. I think tomorrow I'm going to go out, listen to a live band, and drink in public.
Let us know how that goes for you.
I'm not protesting anything. It's just they've opened up the riverfront where I live, and there's going to be a live band and public booze. So,
really?
Sounds like fun.
Go for it, man.
Yeah. Hell, that work, they're not talking about bringing us back into the office till Christmas.
Oh, yeah. I have no idea when I'm going to be back in the office. They actually gave me a USB headset so that I can start taking phone calls. I didn't want to tell them they gave me a crappy one. The one I already use is better. So I've got a crappy USB headset that I'm never going to open up. And right now I'm faking not knowing how to use the software that we do the computer phone calls from because I don't want to take them. And the
well played, sir.
The person that's going to train me is taking the next couple days off, and I realize that I'm also not working tomorrow, so that's going to kind of suck that I can't milk that. But I'm just not going to take anything until I absolutely have to, and hopefully no one remembers that I used to do that for a living. I mean, it's not prominent in my
mind. I haven't done it in forever. It's completely different. It's changed. It's like fucking Windows, man. Last time I did this, Windows had a start button, not that little icon thing. Now you got to say, hey, Siri, before you run anything. I mean, fuck.
What the hell? It wants to sell me shit. I just wanted to play solitaire, damn it.
Yeah, solitaire doesn't even come on the machine anymore. You got to pay for it.
No, it's Mahjong.
You fucking buy it now. Isn't that pathetic? Minesweeper and solitaire you have to buy now?
Yep.
Anyways. So the Galaxy 15 site was down. I don't believe it was down for very long, because I wasn't getting a bunch of angry notes from anybody or anything like that saying, hey, the site's down. But, so just for clarity, it was not an attack. It was not a, there was no breach or anything like that. The CMS software is complaining about connecting to the database because the host I'm using for the site changed up their database system and the URL changed. So I had to go update the DNS in the configuration file on the web server itself to the new address. I had to figure out that the DNS had changed. They had only bothered to post the notice that they were going to change it in the control panel. So since I don't live in the admin control panel for G15, the web hosting space, I only log in there when there's a problem. I didn't see the notice, which apparently had been up for about a month, that they were going to be changing these addresses. So, whoops. So that was an administrative failure. That was not any kind of a malware attack, or nobody breached the site or anything like that. I mean, obviously, I had it corrected in about 5 minutes once we realized something was going on. And so, kind of got me thinking what might be an interesting discussion topic is how you guys go about fixing shit. But I don't know if that's... I don't know how interesting of a conversation that would be, you know? So, I can tell you what I did for the website was... You know, you log in there, and the first thing it says is error connecting to database. That's kind of a big fucking clue that something might be wrong with the database. So, of course, you know, you open up the admin control panel and go start looking at the databases, and, you know, they're there. It won't let me log into the main one, but it's there. And it's like, okay, what's going on here? So, then I see the little alert up at the top. Oh, by the way, we're changing the database URLs. You don't say. So, at that point, it was fairly easy to figure out what to do. Just go get the new URL, plug it into the software, rotate the password anyways, because it had decided, I guess, my password, even though it was 64 fucking characters long, it decided it didn't meet the security requirements because it didn't have a fucking special character in it. So, put a special character in it. and rotate the password, and now we're back to good. So, I don't know if there's really anything to discuss there. I end up having to do little troubleshooting shit like that all the time at work. And again, it's usually like, okay, well, you know, start off with number one. You're supposed to just go on the website, don't work. What does it say? What's the error message? What does it say? It says the database. Oh, that's a clue. As opposed to the shit I get at work of, it won't print. Well, what's it say when you try? I don't know. It just doesn't work. Do you get an error
no
message?
No one copies and pastes the error message to you?
Oh, God, no. No, no, no. You see, there the troubleshooting strategy for most of the end users I get is to scream and cry and want to know why all the files they were storing in the deleted deleted folder in Outlook went away. That's a real conversation, and I have had that conversation with people where they were storing things in the deleted folder in their email. And you have to ask them, do you keep important files in the trash can at your desk, like physical paper? No, that'd be dumb. You realize that deleted folder is the equivalent of a trash can on the computer, right?
Did anyone tell them what the word delete means?
They just knew that
hit the delete key.
They just knew they had a button that would auto-file their email. They thought it was like Gmail. Because Gmail got rid of the delete key and makes everything archive. That's usually what it is. Is they say, well, my Gmail never deletes anything when I hit that button. It's like, it's not fucking Gmail. It's Outlook, and we have to pay for the space.
And it actually scares me that Gmail does that now that I've learned something about the way law enforcement treats emails.
Oh, yeah. If it's older than a couple of months, they can just go get it. They don't need to tell you or anything.
Yeah. That's scary.
Yeah.
That law needs to be updated. If I'm archiving stuff, I mean, you should need to get a warrant to look at my crap.
Well, but that's the downside of storing your shit on other people's computers. The cops don't have to go to you, they go to the other people to get permission. That's one of the stories I have tonight is Apple letting the FBI do that. So, and again, it's not that I necessarily think that it's wrong for the FBI to go to Apple to get data they need. It's just, you should be fucking aware of what your devices are doing. So.
Well, that one, I'll have to hear the story to see whether or not I agree or disagree. Because I can see, depending on what service you're being offered, like whenever Google is promoting endless email, like infinite storage, that becomes my filing cabinet. That's what they're advertising it for. So they should contact me, or, you know, Tina me. it's a data server that I'm being provided.
Well, you see, if they encrypted it and then required you to have the key, one, if you ever lost your password, they couldn't recover it, and that's a bad customer experience, so they won't do that. But two, if they encrypted it, they couldn't mine it for advertising information.
Well, even if it's not encrypted, fine, but the warrant should still go to me instead of Gmail.
Well, or Google. You know, and you got to think this is something Europe tried to do with the GDPR, right? They tried to say that it's your data just because it lives on somebody else's box doesn't change the fact that it's your data. But turns out that's really difficult in practice. I mean, just from a practical level, how do you enforce that, right? Most of these data systems don't have any concept of tagging ownership within the system other than just, I mean, the file has an owner, sure, within the system, but that's not the same as, like, legal ownership or custodianship, I think is the term, of that data, right? So, I understand from a technology perspective why that's a hard ask, because you have to completely re-engineer how this stuff works if you're going to do that kind of, you know, protection and storage. This is where the encryption angle is actually the right way to go, because you can't access it without a key. And supposedly your customer is the only one with the key because it's their data. So, okay, you want to get this data, go get a warrant and get the key from the customer. I think that is the right way to do it. But that's difficult and complex, and of course the police don't like having to ask, because then there's the risk that somebody's either going to, one, say they don't know the key, or two, just delete it as quickly as they can. I mean, of course, you know, technically that's evidence tampering or whatever at that point. And apparently now they have successfully prosecuted people to the point that, like, wiping their phones, even just, you know, it could be suspected of data tampering. It's like, you know, this could have been evidence, and you knew it could have been evidence, so you wiped your phone. It's like, if there's not a case open, how does that work? So now they've actually gone after people for who they should have kept data because it might have become evidence. I was like, ooh, that's a loose standard. I don't know. I
wasn't given notification that I was being investigated. I didn't know I needed to retain files.
That's pretty much it. But it's like, that's a loose standard. And of course, you know, these are just charges, right? You don't know how it's actually going to end up holding up in court, but still. So.
Yeah, that's a bit crazy.
You got anything? Are you ready to move on?
No, I'm good.
All right. First article I have for tonight is from the Register, but this is actually all over the place, so we're just going to use the Register article. RU's posting random YouTube links in there. I'm sure he's rickrolling the chat room.
Therefore, harats.
Ah, that's right. You were talking about those videos of the craziness going on where you are.
Yeah.
So, a U.S. academic has revealed the existence of 2.4 million of a 2.4 million person database he says was compiled by a Chinese company known to supply intelligence, military, and security agencies. The researcher alleged the purpose of the database is enabling influence operations to be conducted against prominent and influential people outside of China. The academic is Chris Balding, an associate professor at the Fulbright University of Vietnam. He says the company is called Shenzhen Xinhua. The security researcher Robert Potter and Balding co-authored a paper claiming the trove is known as the Overseas Key Information Database, and that while most of it could have been scraped from social media or other publicly accessible sources, 10 to 20% of it appears not to have come from any public source of information. The co-authors do not rule out hacking as the source of that data, but also say they have no evidence of such activity. A fundamental purpose appears to be information warfare, the pair stated. Balding wrote on his blog that the database contains the following. The information specifically targets influential individuals and institutions across a variety of industries, from politics to organized crime or technology and academia, to name a few. The database flows from sectors of the Chinese state and linked enterprises are known to target. The breadth of data is also staggering. It compiles information on everyone from key public individuals to low-level individuals in an institution to better monitor and understand how to exert influence when needed. The database includes details of politicians, diplomats, activists, academics, media figures, entrepreneurs, military officers, and government employees. Subjects' close relatives are also listed, along with contact details and affiliations with political and other organizations. In the paper, the pair said that all that data allows Chinese analysts to track key influencers and how news and opinion moves through social media platforms. The data collected about individuals and institutions and the overlaid academic tools from social media platforms provide China enormous benefit in opinion formation, targeting, and messaging. It gets worse. From the assembled data, it's also possible for China, even in individualized meetings, to be able to craft messaging or target the individuals they deem necessary to target. Balding said the database is technically complex, using very advanced language, targeting, and classification tools, but it was also hard to investigate as parts were reportedly corrupt. Balding therefore shared the data trove with Potter of the Australian internet firm or security firm Internet 2.0 to help make it accessible. The results were shared with select non-Reg media outlets. The Register has sought comment from Balding and Internet 2.0, but has not received any at the time of writing. In their written output, Balding and Potter suggests that the open source intelligence database used to create much of the data, or intelligence used to create much of the database, is a breach of many local laws, as users of social networks do not expect or consent to data being shared. Skipping ahead a bit. In a second post, Balding said the database matters because what cannot be underestimated is the breadth and depth of Chinese surveillance state and its extension around the world. So the article goes on, but the gist of it is that this is a collection of dossiers, right? This is a surveillance and influence database, and it has enough information in there to try to influence people, as it were.
Yeah, it's for blackmail.
Yeah. Blackmail, targeting, or even just bribery, right? You know, what do you have to do to get somebody to, you know, go along with the old CCP party line there? And, you know, not only, I mean, I'm not surprised that such a thing exists, because of course it does. I'm sure any intelligence agency worth their salt is either building or hiring somebody to build databases like this all over the world. The amazing part is that it was left out there for in the public to be found. And usually when they don't say where they found it, you know it's got to be like an Amazon S3 bucket.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that would be fucking amazing that they're not even using a Chinese company for their cloud storage.
Well, it might have been. You know, it could have been Baidu or something. But, I mean, because they don't say where they got it. They just say if they found it and it was public. So it's just like, if you're going to build this kind of a dossier, you don't want to just leave that shit lying around. Come on.
You don't want people to find out about it to start with.
Right? I mean.
Yeah, well, when you were listing who all was in there, I'm like, yeah, of course you're going to keep track of close family members. That's one of the ways you pay people off. You don't pay off the Secretary of State for leaking info. Pay off his wife. And you don't send her a check. You give her a job at a very lucrative company that, you know, the corporate headquarters are in Beijing, but their North American headquarters are in whichever state they happen to be living in.
In a conveniently purchased P.O. box, yeah. if they're even bothering with that for the paperwork. But, yeah, I mean, of course, intelligence agencies are building these kind of databases, but letting them leak is just sloppy.
You think it was, we're just so big, no one's going to say anything, so it doesn't matter? Or do you think someone may be losing a head in the Communist Party?
Bit of both. So when this happens, usually what it is you have, so I'm trying to think of the best way to explain this. It's usually not like you have one person who's setting up a cloud account for an organization. Sometimes you do, depending on the size of the organization. But if it's an organization of size, and to have compiled a dossier like this, it's of size, right?
Yeah, because you don't have the people gathering the info actually setting up that database.
Right, but you're going to have an operations team that's going to be setting up your data services. Now, whether they're using Baidu or they're using Amazon or some other cloud provider, they're going to go out there and set up the systems, tell your analysts, here's what we're using, here's your applications, here's your accounts, right? Because every organization does this. It's called an IT department. Everyone has it because they don't expect everyone to set up their own shit. And if they did have everybody set up their own shit, nothing would ever interoperate correctly. Anybody who's ever had to migrate a whole bunch of departmental policies where everybody's got their own Excel files and Word documents into a SharePoint and have it make any kind of coherent sense knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, here's something that also may have hit home. Anyone that ran a LAN party in the 90s.
Yeah, but I had those when we were doing that. I made it work.
Yeah. But they didn't initially talk to anyone. No one's computer saw anyone else's computer until the third round of Quake.
Well,
or at least didn't see every computer.
Well, that was when we figured out that the fucking VMware network driver was interfering with. Anyways, yeah, uninstall VMware, everything worked. It's like, why does that work? I don't know. But yeah, you're right. Back in the day when we didn't really know what we were doing. But so when you have these cloud accounts like this, you have, you know, I've done quite a bit of work in AWS, right? And when you're setting these things up, there's a lot of little steps you have to do. Now, if you're doing it regularly, it makes sense to script it out. You know, write the script, have it hit the APIs, or use something like a Terraform, cloud formation tool, whatever, and that way it's repeatable and you know that you hit all the steps and you have the objects set up correctly. But when you're doing Amazon permissions, a lot of times you still end up having to manually edit the XML and go up and set up an object name and say this permission, you know, it has these rights. And if you're going to get granular with it and really get in there and do it right, you do. You have to manually edit the XML and drop object references in there. And that might sound a little complex, and it can be. It really can be, because these systems are fairly complex because you can do a lot with them. And you can make different parts of the, you know, you can have different parts of the cloud service talking to other different services in the cloud service. And, you know, you've still got to do all the permissions management. You got to do all this. And one of the reasons you have to do it this way is because Amazon is not giving you a whole bunch of checkboxes to make what you need. Like a software as a service does. You know, it's not Office 365 where you just go check some boxes. And you can dig into Office 365 too. That's actually a bad comparison. But they're not selling software as a service. They're just saying, here's the services. Build your own. They're expecting you to build out what you need in there. And that also lets them put it as a clause in their contracts. They're not actually responsible for anything you do in your account. You are responsible for everything. Here's the tools. Yeah. Here's everything that goes in it. It's on you to make sure it's correct.
Yeah, here's the service for an IT department. We're not selling this to end users.
Right. So, that's a better way to put it. It is for an IT department to build services for your end users, and it is not for your end users. Now, that said, a lot of people spin up their own AWS account to play. And if you're not careful, that gets expensive. But
one thing, if we're looking at something with the size of a state actor, I think, don't get me wrong, I do believe the private sector does just about everything better. But there are some things that you just want the government to do. One is run its own data center. So people at Amazon or Baidu or wherever the fuck don't have access to state secrets.
So there's an entire division of Amazon services entirely for government services. There is an Amazon.gov, basically.
Yeah.
And it is purely for doing AWS for government services. They make bank doing it. But anyways, I'm using Amazon because it's what I've messed with the most as far as cloud services go. Some Azure, mostly Amazon, because that's what the companies I've worked at have used. I haven't gone through and set up all this, you know, cloud stuff on my own just to play. But man, I would have back in the day too. Anyways, I'm like, if all this cloud shit had happened when we were still in high school. Yeah, I would have had accounts on all of them. I would have dug through all of them. Just don't have time these days. But anyways, my point is it's very easy for somebody setting this kind of stuff to make a mistake and accidentally make something public. And if you make a mistake and accidentally make like an S3 bucket or a file repo or a database public, like no permissions, everything can talk to it, every tool you run will work. You will not know that something is wrong if all you're going on is how the end users and your software reacts. You will not know that you have accidentally made something public until either A, you find out that it's public through scanning it or checking it on your own or realizing that a permission is wrong. Like, then you go in there to update a permission and realize the previous one was wrong kind of thing. Or two, somebody else tells you that it's public. You know, this is the old joke of using the FBI as your intrusion detection system. It's like, what, you know, tell that one to an auditor. How do you know when you've been breached? Well, the FBI will tell us.
The FBI will ask, why is your server doing this?
Yeah.
And then we have to find out. And the answer is, some guy in Korea decided to put crap on my server. Can we hack them back?
No. In the United States, hacking back is generally illegal, unfortunately.
But they're in Korea. We're not attacking a U.S. citizen. Do Koreans really have rights? I mean, they do have a hold on the world's kimchi, but how important a resource is that?
Madman, I've told this story before. It is the absolute truth. If you're in Russia, China, most countries, and you're hacking somebody who's outside of the country, they don't give a shit. The authorities do not give a shit. But in the United States, if I'm hacking somebody in China, I can get in trouble for it. The FBI will happily arrest me and charge me with computer intrusion, you know.
Because you can't do that, citizen. That's our job. We're the FBI.
No, most likely they'll be offering you a job on the sly in the back end in lieu of, you know, going to jail or paying some fine or whatever. And it generally helps if the company you're hacking doesn't know that they've been hacked and doesn't report it. But usually that's not how... Usually the way... So if the company doesn't report it, usually the way law enforcement gets involved is somebody's bragging. They're either on Twitter or whatever talking about what they've got, or they're distributing data somewhere, whether it's some forum or a leak site or, you know, getting into Tor, IRCs, that kind of thing. So usually that's how somebody gets caught. Is it's not that, you know, if the company doesn't know they've been breached, and 9 times out of 10 they don't, because these systems are complex and nobody wants to spend the money on proper monitoring. You know, yeah, a lot of times they don't know they've been breached. Even when they do have, you know, security and shit like that. So this is why it's so important to set things up right from the get-go. But that's the downside of security. You have to be right all of the time. The attacker only has to be right once. So, yeah, Rats is right. There was an article we talked about, I want to say last year, of some chick who had hacked into a bunch of different things. And she got caught because she was bragging to friends about it. She didn't actually do anything with it other than... I think she posted some of it to GitHub. I think that was it. But yeah, they caught her because she was bragging about it. So, you know, if you're going to do crime, maybe don't post selfies of yourself on Facebook while doing it.
I'll do it for my amusement.
Well, yeah, that's the better thing. If you're going to do something dumb, film it and put it on YouTube so we can all laugh at you.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it'd be BitChute today. YouTube will censor that shit. Somebody will claim copyright on it.
I'll like and subscribe.
BitChute. Best chance. Your best chance of having it survive.
So.
Well, long enough until you have to upload it to the next, you know.
Yeah, until BitChute gets too big and then you got to rotate services again.
Yeah. At least DLive's still good for live shows, and BitChute's good for posting stuff. So landscape's forever changing, my friend.
Speaking of this, we'll get to the article we referenced earlier. This is from Business Insider, although I saw this one posted several places too. Apple gave the FBI access to the iCloud account of a protester accused of setting police cars on fire. As FBI officers were investigating a Seattle man suspected of setting police cars on fire, they turned to Apple for help. In response, Apple granted access to the man's iCloud account, giving the FBI access to screenshots, photos, and videos that are now central to their case against the suspect, the court documents show. You know, the whole taking selfies of yourself setting something on fire. It's routine for Apple to comply with court-issued search warrants by handing over suspects' data to investigators. But the episode, detailed in court documents and previously reported by Forbes, shows just how valuable a suspect's smartphone data can be to an investigation and contrasts with previous public clashes between the FBI and Apple. Federal prosecutors are now charging the suspect, Kelly Jackson of Edmonds, Washington, with two counts of arson and unlawful possession of a deadly device. Jackson is accused of throwing two Molotov cocktails that burned police cars during Seattle protests against police brutality in May. Investigators identified Jackson using surveillance footage and obtained a warrant to search his cell phone location data provided by Verizon. The Verizon data showed the general location of the Jackson's phone when he made six calls on the day of the suspected firebombing, all of which placed him near the scene of the fire. It also revealed he was using an iPhone 7.
Nice.
FBI officers then turned to Apple for information about Jackson's iCloud account. Apple disclosed the name, email, phone number, residential address associated with Jackson's account, and then subsequently granted the FBI access to the contents of Jackson's account in response to a court-ordered search warrant. And I don't really have a problem with Apple complying with a search warrant.
No, search warrants is cool. I'm just questioning, should the warrant have been issued to Apple or to the person whose iCloud account it is? Because I think Apple is, I think in this day and age, it should go to the individual whose account it is and not to the company holding it. And I know it's kind of weird because whenever you're,
What would be a physical analog? If the police,
a storage building?
Yeah, if the police needed access to a storage building, would they go to the owner of the storage building and issue the warrant there and then cut the lock and get in? Or did they issue the warrant to the person who rented the storage building? Or...
And I'm not sure, because some storage buildings you actually sign a lease for, and others you just go in and pay money and get a receipt. So I think if there's a lease for it, they go with the individual, and if there's not, they just take it to the person who has the storage company.
Well, what about if it's a safety deposit box at a bank and they think there's something in the deposit box they want? Do they go to the owner of the safety deposit box, because you are technically the owner while you're paying the fee and have the key, or do they go to the bank before they drill the lock?
I think they go to the bank.
Well,
I'd have to look that up, but I think they go to the bank.
I think that's probably your best analog, is the bank box.
Yeah, so I guess if you just want, the only way to be sure your data is secure and you're the one that gets the warrant is to host your own server farm.
Well, keep your data locally. Don't back it up to iCloud. Of course, now your iPhone does that on its own, unless you specifically go in and turn it off. And I have discovered, even when it's turned off, when the thing updates, it turns shit back on. Not
no,
as bad.
I do think that's crap.
When I was checking after I took my iPad to 14 today, and we were on earlier, and most of the settings I had already changed stayed changed. I didn't notice any that I had turned off getting flipped back on. Now the new stuff that had been added, that was all set to on, but that was easy enough to turn off. So, maybe Apple's getting better about that. Although there was another article earlier in the week that most apps, regardless of the OS they're on, most apps completely ignore the privacy settings. You know, you go in and say, don't share my data, it does it anyways.
Yep.
But anyways, once it had access to the iCloud account, the FBI found screenshots of an Instagram post promoting the protest, a screenshot of a recipe for a Molotov cocktail, and videos of a green glass bottle and an unzipped backpack, according to criminal complaint. I mean, that's just manufacturing. That's just giving them the evidence. It's like, here's the photos. For fuck's sake. They also found
me killing them. Yeah. And here's me dismembering the corpse.
Here's me posing with the body. they also found photos in Jackson's camera roll that appeared to show him wearing the same hoodie seen in surveillance footage. Court documents show just how revealing a suspect's smartphone can be when obtained by federal prosecutors. It also contrasts with federal law enforcement agencies' past gripes accusing Apple of being unwilling to aid investigations. In recent years, Attorney General William Barr has criticized Apple for refusing to help unlock phones. Difference between these cases is that they went for the iCloud account and there's no backdoor. Okay. Anyways, what's Apple supposed to do? Challenge the warrant? That'd be pretty shaky, you know?
I don't think Apple could challenge the warrant. I think whomever the iCloud account belongs to should challenge it in court.
That'd be interesting to hear the outcome of. But, I don't know. Because, again, it sounds like this was definitely the guy who was firebombing police cars. And, I mean, the hacker 4chan seems to be pretty good at picking this stuff up with their weaponized autism. So, I don't know that it matters whether or not they get the iPhone or not. But it's like, there's the evidence. I mean, again, it comes back to you should understand what your devices are doing. And if you're... talk about advice that I shouldn't give. If you're going to participate in potentially illegal activity, maybe don't take your main phone. Maybe get you a burner and set up some dummy accounts.
Oh, doing it right with Morps.
If you get the really cheap burners, the old flip phones and shit like that, the ones that don't cost but like $5, get you a collection of them. That way you can, after the protest, just do the whole Breaking Bad thing, just cracking it in half and tossing it in the dumpster. I know in the show they just tossed it in the street, but you don't need to litter.
Give it to a nice bum. Let him use up the rest of your phone card.
Yeah, here, it's got like 20 minutes on it left.
wipe your fingerprints off first.
If the police come by looking for it, tell them a German man gave it to you. I don't know.
He may have had black hair and a weird mustache. Definitely was not Hitler. Not Hitler.
Sorry, he hasn't slept well since 1945. Anyways, anything on that one, are you?
No, man. I don't have much on phones.
Fair enough. Next one up is from the BBC, and this is a story RU sent me. Canada Tesla driver charged over napping while speeding. A Canadian man has been charged with dangerous driving for allegedly taking a nap while his self-driving Tesla car clocked up more than 90 miles per hour. Police said both front seats were fully reclined, and the driver and passenger were apparently asleep when they were alerted to the incident in Alberta. The Tesla Model S was doing 140 kilometers an hour, but sped up to 150 when a police officer turned on his emergency lights. Well, if the car sped up, I don't think the self-driving would respond like that. It's like, oh, it's the cops, better cheese it. You really think Tesla programmed that into the autopilot?
It learned. These things are supposed to learn how people drive, right?
Yeah.
Sentient.
The 20-year-old driver from British Columbia is due in court in December. He had initially been charged with speeding and handed a 24-hour license suspension for fatigue, but was subsequently charged with dangerous driving. The incident happened near Pinoca, some 100 kilometers south of Edmonton, in July. Nobody was looking out the windshield to see where the car was going, Police Sergeant Derry Turnbull told CNBC News. He said that when they put on the emergency lights, the Tesla accelerated, with the vehicles ahead of it moving out of the way. Nobody appeared to be in the car, but the vehicle sped up because the line was clear in front. He added, I've been policing for over 23 years, and the majority of that in traffic law enforcement, and I'm speechless. I've never, ever seen anything like this before. But of course, the technology wasn't there. Tesla cars can currently operate at a level 2 autopilot, which requires the driver to remain alert and ready to act with hands on the wheel. Yeah. So the thing is about that, I know several people who own Teslas. There's a Tesla dealership, actually, it's up the road. And I know several people who have these cars, and I've seen them demonstrate the autopilot. Not to mention, we went and watched a couple of YouTube videos after this because I couldn't remember. But the autopilot goes nuts if it thinks you're not paying attention. It starts making all kinds of racket and noise and will turn itself off. In the video I saw, it wanted you to nudge the wheel right or left. At first, we were thinking it might be doing the capacitive touch thing. And I was like, well, I guess you could defeat it by wrapping some bologna around the thing or some bacon, like you were saying. But I don't think that's it. From what I saw, it's, you know, the guy had his hand on the wheel. He just didn't nudge it left or right to acknowledge that he was there. And, you know, in the video I saw, the car turned the autopilot off, started slowing down to a stop, and had a big warning up saying that you couldn't use autopilot again for the rest of the drive. So, although that said, when I was searching up YouTube videos to demonstrate the autopilot, I was also finding ones that, you know, how to turn that warning off. So maybe they'd modded the car.
Yeah. Weird story, though.
Very weird, especially because I don't think the car will let you do that.
Yeah. That and the accelerating away thing, I think that might be a little bit of a... porky pie.
Well, it says the passenger seat was down, and I'm thinking there was a passenger in the car. I'm thinking they weren't napping.
Yeah, I'm starting to get that picture too.
So, I don't know. I don't know. But it is funny that they said somebody was using the Tesla to take a nap. I don't think it'll let you do that yet, but. I guess they are working on making the things fully autonomous, so at some point you will be able to just, you know, take a nap in the car, which wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. Yeah, just get in the car, Siri, I'm drunk, take me home.
Oh, that would be amazing. Although I do know several people that have gotten in the car drunk and it magically took them home.
Yeah, I know some dudes who've gotten home and... waking up in the morning, why is my car on the front lawn?
Made it home, along with about 20 feet of fence.
Yeah.
Oh, looks like I picked up a hitchhiker. He was hanging onto the windshield the entire way. Looks like he's still there.
Oh, look, I got a new clothesline with some people's clothes on it.
I don't know, you remember the story we did back in the day in IHN where that lady had the cyclist through a windshield for 2 days? Laid through her windshield.
Oh, yeah. Did she claim she didn't notice or something like that?
She didn't notice, yeah.
It's like crazy bullshit. Story. She just didn't want to call the cops. I don't know. Next article, unless you guys have anything else on that.
No, just pointing out that it's a weird article.
This is from Ars Technica. NVIDIA has officially announced that it is buying ARM from SoftBank for $40 billion. The deal is one of the biggest tech acquisitions of all time, and we'll see NVIDIA control the world's most popular CPU architecture. NVIDIA's press release oddly paints the deal as primarily about AI, saying the deal brings together NVIDIA's leading AI computing platform with ARM's vast ecosystem to create the premier computing company for the age of artificial intelligence. NVIDIA apparently sees GPU-accelerated AI as its next big growth sector, and the company currently sells embedded systems for self-driving cars and multi-GPU systems for workstations and servers. Blah, 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 blah. What seems far more important, though, is how NVIDIA will manage ARM's wide-ranging chip design and architecture licensing business, which powers the majority of world's electronic devices, especially those smaller than a laptop. NVIDIA said that as part of NVIDIA, ARM will continue to operate its open licensing model while maintaining the global customer neutrality that has been foundational to its success. On a conference call following the deal, ARM CEO Simon Segers also reiterated, "We will maintain our neutral business model and keep a level of independence." The two companies don't seem like they will be completely separate, though, with NVIDIA adding ARM partners who also benefit from both companies' offerings, including NVIDIA's numerous innovations. A report from Reuters elaborates on this, saying NVIDIA will expand the model by licensing some of NVIDIA's designs, including its graphical processing unit or GPU technology, through ARM's networks of silicon partners. And that's the real move, ladies and gentlemen. ARM will move from being a Japanese-owned company to being an American-owned company, which is amazing because ARM was originally Acorn, and that was a British company. So,
making its way around the world.
Yep. Which should further worry Chinese companies facing a trade war with the United States. NVIDIA says ARM will remain headquartered in its hometown of Cambridge, England, which NVIDIA wants to turn into a world-class technology center. The company plans to build a state-of-the-art AI supercomputer powered by ARM CPUs on campus. NVIDIA also promises a big boost to ARM's R&D spending. In case this any deal this big is going to be subject to regulatory approval, and NVIDIA says the deal should close in approximately 18 months. So, here's what I think is going to be very interesting. Apple is moving to do ARM-based laptops. They want to move their entire line over to ARM in the next couple of years. I mean, their iPad and iPhones, they call them, you know, they've got their own names for the chips, but it's ARM at its core. They're ARM chips. You know, they've got their own instruction sets and the like on top, but, and, you know, of course, Apple's, you know, doing their own designs, but they're still based on ARM. You've got ARM chips made by all kinds of different companies right now. But one of the things is a lot of these ARM chips have integrated GPUs, you know, on the chip. Usually they have, you know, you'll see them talk about having however many compute cores, however many GPU cores, and now they're starting to add AI cores, which is just a different architecture of core. But and some can even flip, you know, flip the core types from one to the other just based on what they're doing. You know, have fast cores and slow cores and things like that. So it can get really complicated. But what I'm thinking NVIDIA plans on doing here is they're probably coupling, you know, they're probably going to couple NVIDIA GPU technology into the ARM design. Like, ARM is completely open. You can do whatever you want with the CPU portions of it. The GPU portions of it, though, are going to become NVIDIA licensed technology. So if you want to use those, that's going to be something separate. And I bet that's the real play. Somebody call me wrong. I mean, I'm speculating here. I'm open to being wrong on this. I kind of hope I am. But I think that's going to be the real play, is that they're going to use it as a way to get their GPU technology in all these ARM devices.
I'm just seeing through economic news, a lot of players pulling out of China, coming back to America when it comes to tech.
Well, you know, they're looking at a lot of embargoes and trade deals with China. I think we're probably getting ready to go into a...
Well, Huawei's in heap of trouble.
Well, Huawei can't even get the chips they need to build their devices nowadays.
Yeah, the chipsets they need, and from what I understand, China doesn't make that level of chipset. Yet they're not even close with their technology of making it. So, yeah, that's just through trade and things like that. Money news. That you hear a bit of that. There are quite a few companies going to start moving back.
I don't know if as far as moving back, I think they'll move out of China, but that doesn't mean they'll come back to the U.S., at least not for production or a big chunk of it. But as far as Morpheus Hill, this is a way of getting my stuff into everything. I think he's probably right on that.
You're talking years out, right? Because the way ARM works is they license the design and the instruction sets to other companies to actually make the chips. ARM doesn't make chips. You know, Samsung, Broadcom, Intel. Actually, I don't think Intel's making ARM chips. I think they've looked at some of the technology, though. Well, Apple's, you know, licensing it out. And, you know, obviously, you know, they make the chips. But Arm owns all the IP, so they're really an IP clearinghouse, right?
Yeah.
So what I'm talking about, it's probably not going to be to fruition until 10 years, maybe, for chip, you know, for the chips to actually make it all the way through. Microsoft does. Thank you. You know, Rat's saying it's Microsoft. That's right. They did put out a Surface that was ARM-based. But, yeah, they, you know, I think that's what they're going to do. Of course, Apple's already famously severed ties with NVIDIA. You know, a lot of Linux people are upset with NVIDIA right now because of, you know, how difficult they've been to work with on the open source drivers. And, yeah, so I could see them doing that where it's you know, oh, you know, yeah, yeah, here's all the CPU designs you want. Oh, you want the GPUs? Yeah, you have to get an NVIDIA deal for that. Maybe not, you know, maybe they won't discontinue the old GPU stuff that's in ARM now. Like, you know, I mean, some of the stuff's in that's in the GPUs is not bad. You know, all your smartphone games and stuff like that, some of them look pretty good. So, you know, like, I think the Samsung chips have some interesting GPU stuff in them. But, so maybe it won't be quite as much of a, you know, add-on as I'm thinking. But I'm thinking it'll be 5 to 10 years before you start seeing the fruits of that kind of change in licensing. Because they're not going to do it right away either. Because if they bought the company, then immediately did that, you'd have a lot of people crying foul.
It also might not be quite that direct. If they're already doing the design, they just might get their stuff in there because that would be the easiest way to optimize for the game.
Well, there is also one other possibility. Like, I've got a bunch of these older NVIDIA Tegra boards, right, which is basically a development board with a custom ARM chip that has an NVIDIA GPU in it. And they've made several SKUs of those. That's what they were talking about with, like, boards for autonomous cars and stuff like that. It's entirely possible that NVIDIA has some plans on using the ARM designs that would be so expensive that it was cheaper for them to buy the company than to license the technology they needed over time. And given that NVIDIA is a technology company, that's possible. So, anyways, hanging on that story too long, and we're already hitting an hour, so I guess it's a good thing I didn't have anything for Digital Dojo tonight.
besides everything.
Yep. So, next article is from torrentfreak.com. PirateBay.org sold for $50,000 at auction. ThePirateBay.com is up next. The Pirate Bay is arguably the best-known pirate site on the web. The iconic pirate ship logo is notorious around the world, and more than 17 years after it first appeared online, the site still attracts millions of visitors. During its tumultuous history, the Pirate Bay has weathered many storms. The site was targeted in large-scale police raids twice and was the subject of criminal prosecution in Sweden that landed several of its co-founders in prison. The site also faced several domain name issues. In 2012, it switched from its original thepiratebay.org name to thepiratebay.se, fearing that the former would be seized by U.S. authorities. Later on, when the SE domain was threatened, it rotated across several other domains in search of a safe haven. That safe haven turned out to be the original thepiratebay.org domain, from which it still operates today. Over the years, the Pirate Bay had picked up many backup domains, just in case something happened. That included various exotic top-level domains, but the site also owned piratebay.org and thepiratebay.com. We use the past tense because both domains recently expired. The domains listed Pirate Bay co-founder Fredrik Nige as the registrant, and until recently, the same Swedish address was listed in the Whois data. For reasons unknown, however, the registrant let both PirateBay.org and ThePirateBay.com expire. This isn't a problem for the torrent site. The domains were never really used as the site's main address. ThePirateBay.com did forward to the original .org domain at one point, but that's about it. None of this means that the domains are not valuable to outsiders, though. This became apparent in an auction yesterday where piratebay.org, without the, was sold for $50,000 to a bidder named CLVRFLS. the bid below it ended up being the winning one. So yeah, they bid a dollar over somebody bidding $49,999, and they got it.
Wow.
Yeah, if you look at the screenshot of the bids, they were all, you can tell when the auction ended because they were all using bots. You can tell because all the bids were coming in at the last second. PirateBay.org domain failed to renew earlier this month, after which the professional Dropcatch service, Dropcatch.com, scooped it up. They auctioned the domain off, from which is common practice, and proved to be quite lucrative. Man, that's a service. Just watching for a domain to accidentally expire from somebody who's not watching it or doesn't have auto renewal set up. Grabbing it and auctioning it off.
Yeah.
Oh, that's, oh, no. ThePirateBay.org still loads the original site and is not going anywhere. These are just some of the extra domains they had picked up.
Yeah, that game is as old as the internet.
Oh, yeah. It's just still, damn. Domain trader and investor Rodney Hackney, who highlighted the auction at The Domains, tells us that the price itself is not unusual, but for this particular domain, it seems on the high end. The price seems high for a traditional domain investor, given the history of the name. Names sell for big money every day due to a number of factors. Sometimes it's due to what SEO factors see, like high domain authority and backlinks. This view is shared by domain trader David Marshall, who joined yesterday's auction but stopped bidding after the price went above his valuation. I didn't think it would go that high, and I don't believe it's worth this much, Marshall tells us. He adding that he planned to monetize PirateBay.org through legitimate advertising feeds, as he does with many other piracy-related domains. Oh, so he buys up piracy sites and just fills them with ads. I mean, yeah, I can see it.
If it works for him, man.
Well, especially if you've got it scripted. Oh, I bet he's one of those guys who owns the all the domains. Like, if you try searching Google or any other search engine for whatever torrent, you'll usually find a whole bunch of fake sites. And I mean fake sites. They say they have exactly what you're looking for, .torrent, you know, whatever your search string was. And they're full of ads, and they're full of redirects. And if you ever try to see if any of them are real, like, I got bored one day and was trying it, and, you know, using one of my VMs, just, you know, kept going to see how far it got. Well, one, you see stupid amounts of ads, which, you know, whoop, you do. If it killed the VM, I just killed the VM. I don't care. It's just a Ubuntu thing. You spin one up in 5 minutes. But the funniest thing was, by the time you finally got through it all, you know, after seeing 5 or 6 fake Windows errors telling me to install a fake antivirus and all this other shit, you finally get to the end of it. Oh, it was removed.
Yeah.
So,
yep. There's a lot of those places, man.
I bet that's what this guy's doing, is he's snapping up old pirate sites and putting those scripts on it, and I bet that makes him tons of money. Because, you know, you get 20 ad loads from just going to the page once to see if it's real or not, let alone digging through it to see if it actually goes someplace real. Because I've seen other sites like that, that what they're doing is scraping another page that is real, and if you follow it through enough, you'll eventually find the other page. And some of those domains we used to use, that's how I found a couple of the ones I was using. So you go through those scraper sites long enough, you eventually make it to the real domain. But anyways, yeah, so apparently thepiratebay.com is expected to drop later this week, and so far piratebay.net and thepiratebay.net will also drop in a few days. So the upshot is that somebody's going to make a lot of money. The downshot is we're going to see some fake copies of the Pirate Bay spin up again with the previous domain names that they used to use. So if you're going to use Pirate Bay for anything, be really certain about what URLs you're using.
Which ones do you think Google is going to be pushing? Well, on their search results.
Well, who knows? But the original site is thepiratebay.org. So if you're going to use Pirate Bay, one, use a VM. Two, you know, maybe install as many ad blockers as your browser will run without crashing. And I'm not saying that because I don't think they deserve to make money from the ads. I'm saying that because a lot of piracy sites, including the Pirate Bay, their advertising services aren't exactly the cleanest. You know, it's not the site with the ads on it that's trying to push the fake antivirus on you. It's you know, somebody's bought space on an advertiser network that's, you know, allows JavaScript and shit like that. So that's where that shit comes from. And the last story I have for tonight is kind of just funny. This is from Ars Technica. It is now possible to detect counterfeit whiskey without opening the bottle.
There's counterfeit whiskey?
Well, yes. Some whiskeys are like, if you have a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle, they only make so much of it. Those bottles are stupid rare, and they're very expensive straight, I mean, even straight from the bottler. You know, straight from the
yeah, it's like $600 or $700 straight from the distillery, and you can easily sell it for $1,000.
I've seen them auction for $5 routinely.
Wow.
Now that's one of the most absurdly expensive whiskeys. And the funniest part is, I've tried a shot of it. I didn't think it was that good. But with whiskey, you have to remember the pricing on whiskey is not how good is the whiskey. It's rarity. It's how rare is it. So it's really nice when you happen to find a skew of whiskey that you like and is cheap. So, but, you know, again, that goes back to the old adage of, you know, drink what you like. Don't drink what you think is trendy or cool. Just, you know, find what you like and drink it and just understand I'm going to make fun of you for it anyways. So.
Yes, and you can't go wrong with Woodford Reserve.
No, Woodford's good. I like Woodford's.
Gonna have to try that one day.
Next time you're in the States, I will gladly bring a bottle.
I was gonna say I'll get you a bottle when you're in the States. It's not a big deal. That's the nice thing. At least around here, Woodford's is easy to get. Well, we live near where they make most of it, so it's not hard for us to get most whiskeys.
Most bourbons.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, not Scotch. Scotch is not made here.
Yeah.
So let's get back to the article here. There's nothing quite like the pleasure of sipping a fine Scotch whiskey for those whose tastes run to such indulgences. But how can you be sure you're paying for the real deal and not some cheap counterfeit? Good news! Physicists at the University of Andrews in Scotland have figured out how to test the authenticity of bottles of fine Scotch whiskey using laser light without having to ever open the bottles. They described their work in a recent paper published in the journal Analytic Methods. As Ars reported last year, there is an exploding demand for expensive rare whiskeys, yes, even in the middle of a global pandemic. So naturally, there has been a corresponding increase in the number of counterfeit bottles infiltrating the market. A 2018 study subjected 55 randomly selected bottles from auctions, private collections, and retailers to radiocarbon dating and found that 21 of them were either outright fakes or not distilled in the year that claimed on the bottle. 10 of the fakes were supposed to be single malt scotches from 1900 or earlier, prompting Rare Whiskey 101 co-founder David Robertson to publicly declare it is our genuine belief that every purported pre-1900 bottle should assume to be fake until proved genuine, certainly if the bottle claims to be a single malt scotch whiskey. There's also an influx of counterfeit cheaper whiskeys seeping into the market, which could pose an even greater challenge, albeit less of a headline-grabbing one. That's what prompted Alistair Clark of the University of Glasgow to develop an artificial tongue capable of distinguishing between different brands of whiskey. Announced last year, his device consisted of two nanometal taste buds, one gold, the other aluminum, placed side by side and arranged in a checkerboard pattern. Each is chemically modified and then monitored to see how the nanometals' interaction with light changes in response to contact with the liquid. Having two taste buds on the artificial tongue gave them two distinct optical profiles of three different whiskies used in the experiments: Glenfiddich, Glenmarnock, and Larp. Oh God, how do you say that one? Larprog, Laphroaig. Laphroaig.
Yeah.
Oh, that's Laphroaig. I'm an idiot. That's Laphroaig. Okay. I have been drinking. However, Clark's artificial tongue isn't looking for a specific kind of chemical. That's what makes it a tongue as opposed to a sensor. Human tongues can distinguish between black coffee and apple juice, for instance, not because we sense particular chemicals in each, but because over time we've learned to associate a certain flavor profile with each. That's essentially what Clark's artificial tongue is doing. You still have to open the bottles to use the tongue, whiskey producer. So now they're... Anyways, it keeps going on there. But basically, using lasers and, you know, optical analysis, they're basically figuring out how to tell if it's really the right whiskey. But it sounds like they still need the correct... a genuine one to compare it against.
Yeah, because I could see the science. We do something similar to see the composition of distant planets. We wait for the star to get between the planet to get between us and whatever star it's circling, and then just measure what's changed in the light spectrum. So they're just shining a light through the whiskey and seeing what's in the spectrum, what's changed from the spectrum, and seeing what chemicals that corresponds to. But you would still need to have a genuine bottle to compare that to know what it's supposed to look like.
I still think it's awesome.
Oh, I think it's pretty cool. But for it to be useful, you need to have zapped a bottle of, I don't know, 1920s Jameson to compare all 1920 Jamesons to.
Yeah.
And, oh, whiskeys aren't quite that exact, though. I mean, we really learned that at the last Brewfest we went to, where trying the Four Roses. How the different yeasts made the different flavors, even though the mashes were the same.
Oh, yeah.
So that was a different chemical composite just from changing the yeast strain, or the same yeast strains with slightly different mashes.
And that sucks because now my absolute favorite whiskey cost about $100 a bottle. So I can't get it that often because that's expensive.
Oh, that's the strain that you liked? They charge that much for the Oh, yeah, because it's individual store. It's not even... Oh, yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, because I've tried a couple of their single barrels and their blends to see if any of them were close. No. I have found the bottle twice. I bought it once since then, and I know what the letters on the side I want to look for. But, yeah, it's just like, damn it, you know?
So, yeah,
it's like you buy the bottle and see how long you can make it last, which for me is a problem because my whiskey collections tend to evaporate.
But for this laser trick to work, they would need to have a very large catalog of samples to compare everything to.
Well, if you get with the right collectors, that's actually possible because you're not opening the bottle. It's like, hey, we just want to shine a laser through the bottle for 5 minutes and record it and what it is. Of course, that's assuming you trust the collector to actually have a accurate collection.
Yeah.
And, of course, every collector's going to think they do.
Think they do.
Yeah, every collector's going to think they do.
But this is one weird thing that I never really thought of collecting. Same thing with wines. I know you can get a collection and a bottle of wine can go up in value. It could be an asset. Wine is for drinking. Whiskey's for drinking. It's not for... setting up your retirement. If I get a bottle of Pappy, we're drinking it.
Well, yeah. Then we're going to keep the bottle, fill it up with something else and auction. I mean,
Oh, I think I know how to get around this on eBay with their descriptions. We typed in bottle of Pappy Van Winkle piss. Do you think that would...
You're a sick, sick man.
I guarantee you, that was once Pappy Van Winkle. Like selling the Xbox box.
As well as a bit of water, Dr. Pepper, a few other things in there. It's like, why do you have piss in 1-point font at the end there? I don't know. Sick.
Well, we're either doing that or the bottle, the Pappy Van Winkle bottle.
Well, yeah, I mean, actually, people probably do sell those. Fuck. Anyways, that's all I've got for tonight. No Digital Dojo tonight, unfortunately. rats contains aromatic notes of asparagus. Oh, God. people are sick. Anyways, that's all.
That's just for the neon green color.
So, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Pure Decking every Thursday. The Galaxy 15 radio site and subreddit, IRC. And I have gotten some feedback in the IRC. Some good feedback, actually. So, that's helpful. Madman, closing thoughts.
But I have nothing.
Steal my closing thoughts, you bastard. Absolute bastard.
So, do I even need to ask, are you?
I got nothing.
All right. No Digital Dojo tonight. Sorry about that. I just didn't have anything all that interesting to put in it, so I'd rather... And we still did, you know, hour and 15, so... That's it. Playing noises.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Down to go nose down and call it a night.
Shut up, Wesley.